Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Kerala is being escorted through the preservatory by Jordan for a meeting with the abbot. Chapter 18. As Jordan led Kerala through the preservatory, Kerala had to admit she was now thoroughly lost, although she was beginning to notice when she was moving from one area to another by subtle differences in the condition of the stonework, especially the floor. Older and well-traveled sections showed smooth depressions where countless feet had worn down the stone. The hallways had the same basic construction throughout the complex, but there were stylistic changes in the carved decorations. On the first floor, there had been multi-pointed starbursts carved into the arches. In this higher corridor, those had been replaced by flowers. Hall of Stars? Hall of Flowers? She thought to herself. I wonder if that's how the monks label them. I also wonder if anyone's ever tried to make a map of this place. At last, Jordan led her up one more flight of stairs, which ended in a room. A single door was in the wall at the far end. Two older monks, one male, one female, sat at wooden tables, going over what looked like account books. They both looked up as Jordan and Kerala entered, and she recognized them as two of the senior monks that had been at the main table in the dining hall. The woman, in fact, was the one who had led the assembly in the evening prayer.
"Good morning, Jordan," she said with affection. "The abbot said you'd be coming along presently."
"Sister Arvin," Jordan said with a nod. "Brother Lazam, good morning to you both."
"You took your time, young man," said Lazam. "Like as not the abbot's halfway done with his breakfast by now."
He sighed, making a disapproving ticking sound behind his teeth as he rose.
"I'll let him know his guest has arrived. Hopefully her food's still warm."
Arvin gave Jordan a sympathetic shake of her head as Lazam knocked on the door and stepped through.
"You're not late," she assured the young man. "He's only just come in a few minutes before you. Thank you for bringing her here."
"Of course, sister."
Jordan gave her another nod and turned to go.
"Not so fast, lad," Arvin called after him, pointing to a chair against the wall. "You're to wait here until she's done."
"I am," Jordan asked.
"You don't expect her to find her way back down on her own the first time, do you?" Arvin laughed. "We have some food set aside for you as well. You'll not starve while waiting."
Jordan looked embarrassed, but nodded in acquiescence and sat down. Brother Lazam came back through the door not long afterward.
"He's ready for you, mistress," he said with a nod, gesturing toward the open door, then closing it behind her after she'd gone through.
At first, Kerala thought she'd been led into a storeroom. Bookcases lined every wall and were packed full. One held nothing but logbooks of a similar size and shape to the ones Arvin and Lazam were working on, and the shelves of the others sagged under the weight of thick leather-bound tomes so large that a child might have trouble carrying one, as well as smaller books, scrolls, and stacks of individual pages that were collected in boxes. There were three tables in the room as well, two of which were completely covered with towers of books and papers, and like the shelves, appeared on the verge of collapse. The air was thick with the smell of old books, reminding Kerala of the Duke's library, but that pleasant musty odor was much more concentrated here. The third table was on the far side of the room, which turned out to be longer than Kerala had first thought. Three windows, set high on that back wall, sent shafts of light into the room. All three windows were propped open, and Kerala could see the dust motes swirling through the light, carried by the breeze. The abbot was seated behind this far table. Unlike every other flat surface in the room, his table had very little upon it. There were two covered platters, one in front of him and the other on the opposite side of the table. To his left was another logbook, and to his right was a carved wooden stand holding an inkwell and three quill pens, and a shallow box holding a stack of what looked like blank sheets of paper.
"A proper introduction at last, Mistress, Sakirlun," the abbot called to her as she approached. "I hope I'm not mangling your name. Stephen's message didn't include a pronunciation guide."
"It's very good for a first try, Father. Is that the proper term for you?"
"Indeed. I am a priest as well as an abbot,"
Banbrook said with a smile as she sat down across from him. He lifted the cover on his and her platters, revealing a collection of fruits, bread, a cup of milk, and a poached egg for each of them.
"Let us eat before we get down to business."
Kerla had no objections to that, starting in on her meal with relish. The abbot watched her as he ate his own meal, and it was not until after she set her empty platter to one side that he spoke.
"You have quite an appetite, mistress. I hope you'll forgive my forwardness when I ask if that is a common trait among your people."
"My people," Kerla said, finishing the last of her milk before setting that cup on the platter as well. "His grace told you about me?"
"Yes, he shared your true nature with me and said that you would be concealing it with your magic."
"Is that a problem?" "I don't mean to be rude," she said, raising her hands as the abbot's brow creased, "but I have no wish for my nature to be a cause for trouble. I've had problems in the past with followers of the triad who hunt my people, and I found it's better to know these things right away."
"You have nothing to fear within these walls," the abbot pronounced, and there was anger in his voice, but it was not directed at her. "Nothing I have heard or seen has ever given me cause to believe that your folk are monsters, and I speak from personal experience."
Kerla was taken aback. "Oh, you mean elves have come here before?"
"Ah, no," the abbot said with genuine regret. "You are the first to grace us with your presence. To be frank, I did not think any elves had come this far south until I received Stephen's letter mentioning you. My encounter took place in Terrandor. Oh, it must be over 30 years ago now. It is common for younger brothers to deliver messages for the abbey, and in my turn such tasks fell to me. It was during one of these journeys that I met Faran."
He looked at Kerla. "Do you know him?" "I'm sorry, no. And to be frank with you in turn, Father, it sounds as if your meeting with him took place before I was born." The abbot looked flustered for a moment.
"Ah."
He cleared his throat.
"Well, I was in Terrandor, and the caravan I was traveling with stopped at an inn for the night. Faran was already there, and he approached me."
The abbot smiled at the memory.
"Such a strange appearance. Long hair, white as a cloud, and his skin was very pale, with a silvery sheen."
"Air clan," Kerla knew, though she didn't voice this. She didn't want to distract the abbot from his story.
"It turned out that he recognized me as a monk from my clothes, and he was curious about where I was from. We talked through the night, and I found him to be a most intelligent and perceptive individual, genuinely curious about the world that he was now in."
"Did he say anything about the world that he was from?" Kerla asked. The abbot paused, thinking.
"I did ask him about the Elflands, of course, but he said that he only wished to look forward, not back."
He shrugged.
"He struck me as someone who missed his homeland, but whatever prompted him to leave, he did not wish to revisit it."
Kerla sighed. "That seems to be a common trait among my people. My father wouldn't discuss it with me either." The abbot nodded.
"Very well. Then, returning to the present, as the only member of the abbey who knows what you are, I would advise you to maintain your disguise while you are with us."
"For my own safety?"
"For your privacy. I fervently believe that none of my brethren would wish you harm if they learned the truth. But," he said with a chuckle, "you would not get a moment's peace. Their calling would compel each of them to ask you 1,000 questions."
He smiled at her with an exaggerated, tragic pose.
"I assure you, I have 1,000 questions of my own. But at times, an abbot must put such things aside and look at the bigger picture."
Kerla laughed. "Well, I might have time to answer some of those questions, Father. Our ship was damaged on the voyage here. Her captain needs time to get her seaworthy once more." The abbot looked troubled.
"I thought you'd be taking Jordan out of here as soon as possible. That was what Stephen indicated to me in his last message."
"Believe me, I would like to do just that," Kerla agreed. "But until the ship's ready to leave, this place seems safer than my poor, even with Ali Fane here."
The abbot gave her a grudging nod. "How long will the repairs take?"
"The captain estimated 2 weeks. If you factor in travel time back to Maipur itself, I'd like to stay here at least a week, perhaps longer. And it gives me time to talk to Jordan some more. We didn't really get off on the right foot, as I'm sure you've heard." The abbot gave a wry chuckle at that. Tesca didn't get a chance to tell me anything about him, Carla went on. Not the least how old he is. I was expecting to find a little boy, and instead... She threw up her hands.
He is almost a man grown, the abbot said, finishing her thought.
What can you tell me about him? She asked. Does he know who he is?
No, the abbot told her, although he likely suspects. He's been here too long not to.
What do you mean by that?
As a community, we have devoted our lives to unraveling the mysteries of the world. We value curiosity and intellectual thoroughness as two of the primary tools in that endeavor. Jordan has been taught to develop those tools from an early age, and he has accumulated a number of minor clues over the years, slight differences in the way he is treated that suggest he is not the result of an indiscretion between two monks. Normally, when our foundlings turn 18, they have the option of joining us, becoming monks themselves. Usually those who wish to stay have heard the father's call well before that, and they make their intentions known to me. Then we begin an informal procedure to prepare them for the transition. He sighed. Last year I had to dissuade Jordan from that.
Carla's eyes widened as her stomach lurched. He wants to become a monk?
The abbot gave her a kind smile. He thinks he does.
But you don't.
I dare say that I know Jordan better than anyone else. He is extremely intelligent, one of the best students this abbey has ever produced, and has an intuitive genius for research, finding documents in the archives that even older monks have been unable to track down for years. And he believes in what we do here. His faith is strong. But, he said, before pausing with regret, he does not hear the Father's call as we do. He does not have a question.
Carla was struck by the reverence the abbot gave the word. A question.
When one of us hears the call, it most often comes as a great question that we devote our lives to answering. Why is the sky blue? Or what allows birds to fly when man cannot? And in the pursuit of this question, we expand our knowledge of the world. We learn to ask many smaller questions, hundreds more, thousands more. Each of these is a stone on the path toward the answer we seek.
Carla nodded. So, what happens if one of you answers their question? What if a monk found out why the sky is blue?
The abbot smiled. Well, the father would give him a new question, formed from the countless other smaller ones he has been asking since he came here.
Carla returned the smile, hearing in the abbot's words an echo of the hymns from this morning's service. So, Jordan does not have a question.
No, he doesn't, the abbot answered, and I am quite sure he knows it. He loves this place. It's the only home he has ever known. His desire to remain is born out of the realization that his time here is nearly at an end. But the truth is, beneath that fear, he is desperate to leave. Reading about the world outside these walls is no longer enough for him.
I got a sense of that yesterday when he came outside with Hallam to greet us, Carla said, chuckling as the abbot rolled his eyes.
My heart nearly stopped when Brother Hallam told me about it before dinner, Banbrook muttered. But yes, he's almost always on hand the instant visitors arrive at the abbey. Like as not, the only reason he hasn't been pestering you with questions about where you came from is that he's too embarrassed.
The abbot took another bite of his breakfast, chewed it, and sighed.
Despite this very pleasant breakfast we've shared, my dear, believe me when I say that this is not an easy life. We forsake many things when we answer the Father's call. Some of us take our vows without needing to experience what we are giving up. Jordan is not such a person.
You only have to see the way he looks at Allie Fane to know that, Carla sighed.
The abbot laughed. I'm certainly not encouraging him on that particular course.
Then he turned serious.
I am quite certain, however, that if he were to take his vows without ever leaving the abbey, he would come to regret his decision. I could not live with that on my conscience.
Carla nodded. And if he comes back to Kohane with me, and then in a year or two finds his question, what if he wants to come back after that?
If I believed he heard the call, the abbot said, I would welcome him with open arms. Very likely that would cost me Stephen's friendship, which would grieve me, but I could never turn away someone the father has sent to us.
She nodded. Well, that's a dilemma for another time. Earlier, you sounded as if you were hoping I'd be taking Jordan out of here today. What's wrong?
The abbot sighed. I never imagined Stephen would take so long in collecting the lad. I expected Jordan to be in Kohane by the time he was 12, or 15 at the latest. But Stephen was convinced that he could not adequately protect Jordan from Draxon Fane. So we waited. And waited. Now Jordan's only a half year shy of his 18th birthday. I told Stephen once that happens, I must tell Jordan the truth. For a friend, I will lie to a boy. I will not lie to a man.
I understand, Father, but that can't be the reason for your urgency. An extra week here isn't the same as 6 months. She watched the abbot, seeing his awkward silence. It's the pilgrims, isn't it?
Not entirely, the abbot evaded. Pilgrims we've dealt with many times before. A person or a community hears rumors of healing miracles taking place here, they put on the white, and they come. We do what we can for them, but often those who have survived the journey are suffering from a condition that is beyond our skill. We document their condition, adding the information to our medical archives, and give them what care we can. But this is not a hospital. Those who seek to stay must join in the daily labors as best they can, such as helping in the greenhouses or tending to the flocks. Eventually, these hopefuls either depart or pass away, though on at least one occasion, a pilgrim has put aside the white for the brown and has joined our ranks, once he came to understand our purpose here and found a question in his heart.
That throng outside isn't just a few hopeful souls seeking a miracle, Carla pointed out. What's different this time? Is it the sword priests?
Banbrook sighed. You recognize them, then.
One of my companions has a father who used to be an acolyte of the sun. What I don't understand is why they've put on the white themselves and taken charge of the pilgrims, even leading them in their form of daily prayer.
The abbot rolled his eyes. That incessant shouting! How is someone supposed to get any work done with that noise?
But what are they doing here? She began, when there came a knock at the door, and Brother Lazam came in, shutting the door behind him.
Abbot, I'm very sorry, but she's here.
For the first time since Carla had met him, the abbot looked annoyed.
She's early.
Shall I tell her to wait?
Lazam asked, sounding hopeful.
No, the abbot sighed, I'll never hear the end of it. Let's make this as brief as necessary.
He looked at Carla.
Do you mind?
Not at all, Carla replied, knowing who it had to be at the door. Lazam nodded to the abbot and left.
I would suggest that you say as little to her as possible, the abbot warned Carla.
Oh, Allie and I are in general agreement about that, she said with a grin. Her grin faltered when she saw the confusion on the abbot's face, and as the door opened once more, the firm tread of booted feet told her that whoever had entered the room, it wasn't Allie Fane.
Good morning, the abbot said. You're early.
Isn't early, father,
quipped a woman's voice, older, crisp, with a thick Terrandon accent.
Been up since done, much to do. Inconvenient it is, coming all the way up here to answer your summons.
I am sorry you feel that way, the abbot replied, but I too have been up since dawn, and this is where I conduct my meetings. He nodded to Carla, as you can see.
The woman did not respond as she came to a halt next to Carla, standing before the abbot's desk. Glancing up, Carla was startled to see how tall the newcomer was. She was reminded of the Duke's physician, Dr. Marin, but where Marin was a full-figured woman, the abbot's visitor had few curves, her face and neck drawing in with age, her cheekbones and chin sharpening. Her hair, falling just short of her shoulders, was steel gray with lingering traces of dark brown and held back from her face by a band of white cloth around her temples. She wore a pilgrim's white tunic and breeches, far cleaner and in better condition than what the other pilgrims wore, and her stiff bearing made even these simple garments a uniform. The woman turned her head slowly to regard Carla. Her eyes were a pale gray, taking in every detail of Carla's appearance.
And you are?
The abbot's guest, Carla replied, the same as you. A muscle flexed in the woman's jaw. "My name for yours," Carla offered. "A fair exchange." Carla wasn't trying to pick a fight, but the woman had not asked for her name, she demanded it, and Carla was not willing to grant this woman any authority over her. The abbot cleared his throat.
"Introductions, then. This is Sword Commander Kelisandra Fletcher."
"Put aside the red for the white I have, father," Fletcher replied. "I'll ask you not to shame me with a rank I don't claim."
"Of course," the abbot said with a nod.
Carla stood up and offered Fletcher her hand.
"A pleasure to meet you, ma'am. I'm Kay Sakir."
This was not an impromptu answer. Most of her friends called her Kay because they had trouble pronouncing her first name, to say nothing of how they botched her clan name. So she had decided, when wearing a human face but not using a specific cover identity, this was the name she would give.
"Sakir," Kelisandra repeated as she took Carla's hand with little warmth and less duration. "Sounds kefi."
"Suramese, actually," Carla explained. "The name may be from Al-Kef, but that was many generations ago."
"You're of the faith, then?"
Carla nodded. "I am the escort for one of the scholars visiting the abbey."
"One of the Sabrians," Fletcher said. "Had a tussle with Padraic yesterday, you did."
Carla shrugged. It seemed the best way to keep the situation from escalating.
"Kelisandra, I summoned you here because of that altercation," the abbot interjected. "One of your brethren made an unprovoked assault upon a resident of the abbey."
"Unprovoked," Kelisandra snapped, her gray eyes flashing. "Boy was disrespectful and condescending, lording it over a blooded defender of the faith he was. Sacrifices made by men like Padraic are what allow that boy to hide behind these walls and indulge himself in study."
She smiled.
"Few bruises are just reward for his behavior, they are."
"And what reward has Padraic received?" asked the abbot.
Fletcher shrugged.
"Came to me, he did. Admitted his part. Willingly subjected himself to discipline of 10 lashes. Properly contrite he is. He'll behave himself in the future."
She shook her head slowly.
"Wouldn't have happened if you'd opened your gates to the faithful."
"So you've said, more than once. What I find interesting is that virtually all of these new arrivals are from Eastern Terrandor, which, by a strange coincidence, is where you came from as well."
Fletcher looked mildly amused, a flicker of pride crossing her face.
"Didn't ask any to follow me, but I'll not turn my back on them who did. Remember this, for every pilgrim you see outside, there's 2 that didn't survive the journey. Folk as that who've made such sacrifice can't be asked to turn around and go home."
"But there is nothing we can do for them," the abbot said, his patience fraying. "They have come for miracles, which we cannot offer and have never made any claims to."
"Can't offer or won't?" Fletcher asked. "Same's miracles are happening without your say-so."
She shrugged.
"All in the hands of the triad, though. If you weren't so quick to kick me and my boys outside, we'd not have been on hand to witness the miracles of the blessed. That's more than you've done."
"You've no way to know, as you won't allow us to approach them," the abbot objected. "We are as delighted as you are to hear of these events. We seek nothing more than to study those people and determine the cause of their recoveries."
Fletcher's nostrils flared as her lip curled back.
"You don't study miracles. You accept them."
Banbrook rubbed his eyes. "I have received complaints that farms and travelers between here and Maipur are being asked for the gracious gift, rather aggressively, and sometimes more than once."
"Way I hear it," Kelisandra countered, "road's a fair slice safer now that my boys have strung up every bandit fool enough to cross them. You'd think these islanders would be more grateful."
She made a derisive shake of her head.
"Soft, safe little farmers out here on these soft, safe little islands. Back home, folk knew the only thing keeping the kefi back was us. Made the gift of their own accord, they did, and grateful to do it."
She shrugged.
"Doubt we're receiving more than the bandits were taking anyway, and our need is greater. Only just coming on to planting season now. Harvest is months away, and each caravan brings more mouths to feed."
She folded her arms in a resolute pose.
"Triads brought us here for a purpose they have. We'll stay to carry out their will."
"Kelisandra," the abbot warned, If I am receiving these complaints, then you can be certain Count Valion is as well.
Valion, Fletcher sneered. Seems common custom in these parts to put out those they haven't the time for. But this little island lord doesn't dare risk persecuting the faithful.
You haven't been his neighbor for the past 2 decades, playing chess with him all that time, the abbot said. You don't know him as well as you should.
Fletcher shrugged, unconvinced, and the abbot went on.
I asked you here this morning to discuss ways that we might reduce this charity being imposed upon Valion's people.
His voice lowered, and both women heard a touch of anger come into it.
However, understand this. While I admit that some of the younger members of my flock may speak when they should be silent, I will not condone violence committed upon any of them, nor will I tolerate visitors to the abbey being detained or harassed as they enter or leave. Such things violate our calling, a calling that has the sanction of the hierarchs themselves, in case you had forgotten.
Fletcher's mouth grew tight. Hadn't?
Of course.
The abbot turned to Kerla, a measure of his earlier cheerfulness returning.
Now, my dear, I'm afraid I have to cut our meeting short.
That's all right, father, Kerla said. Only one thing left. She took the message she had written for the Duke out of her pocket and handed it to him. The answer to last night's question.
Ah, thank you, the abbot said, accepting the message. I'll take care of it straight away.
Kerla bowed to him and nodded to Kelisandra, offering her the chair. Then she left without waiting to see if the woman sat down. The moment she opened the door to the antechamber, she could sense the tension in the room. Jordan was seated in a chair against the wall, trying his best to ignore Padraic, who was standing very close to him. He was not saying anything to Jordan, simply looming, encroaching on the youth's personal space. The two monks, Arvin and Lazam, did their best to ignore the situation, having little experience with this sort of behavior. Padraic snapped to attention when he heard Kerla enter, but quickly relaxed when he saw that it wasn't Kelisandra. Then he did a double take, recognizing Kerla.
"Wondering when I'd see you again," he said with a fierce grin. "Looking forward to another dance."
He looked at Jordan.
"It's all right now, boy. Your escort's here, she is. Safe as houses."
"He always was," Kerla said. "Or did you want another 10 lashes? Padraic's grin slipped as she walked up to Jordan and took his hand, drawing him up from the chair. "Besides, he's actually my escort." And with that, she stood on her toes and kissed Jordan's cheek, then hooked her arm around the stunned youth's elbow and guided him toward the stairs, past the two monks and a goggle-eyed Padraic.
"Triad smile upon you," she called back.
It wasn't until they'd been making their way back through the halls and stairs of the preservatory for a full minute before Jordan finally stopped.
"What was that?"
he asked, still blushing, his bruises even more colorful. Kerla burst out laughing.
"I'm sorry, but it seemed the best way to put one over on Padraic. Backing down shows weakness, and confronting him just makes him more eager for a fight."
"I don't think he's got a fight on his mind when he looks at you," Jordan snapped.
"It's all the same thing with sword priests."
This lightened Jordan's mood, drawing a laugh out of him.
"So," she went on, "I figured it was best to just pull the rug out from under him and walk away."
"It worked," Jordan said.
He hesitated, embarrassed.
Thank you."
"For what?"
"For making it seem like I was your escort."
"Well, you are. I'd be lost in here for days if you weren't guiding me out."
She smiled as Jordan raised an eyebrow at that.
"All right, hours at least."
"Hours, I'll believe," Jordan said.
He offered her his arm once again.
"And now, mistress, to the map archives?"
"Yes, please," she said, taking his arm.
"And if it's not too much trouble, could you go more slowly? I don't mind having an escort, but I like learning my way around a place."
Jordan grinned at her and set off in a new direction, taking a side hallway, which led to a stone spiral staircase going down.
"So, who exactly is that Fletcher woman?"
They reached the bottom of the stairs, where hallways ran off in 3 different directions. Jordan led her down one of the corridors before answering.
"She's a sword commander in the Order of the Sun, a fairly high rank. The others are her personal guard. Most of them have been with her for years.
I'd been talking with one of the acolytes, a fellow named Liam, before the abbot asked them to move outside to the farmstead. They're not all asses like Padraic. Kerala laughed. Anyway, Liam said that Fletcher spent her entire calling on the eastern border of Terrandor, fighting in the border wars with the Kefi. I don't know how you would say it in Kefi, but apparently their name for her translates as the Mother of Steel.
Kerala made a low whistle at that as they came into a wider room, with stone columns spaced evenly through to support the ceiling.
I wonder if Wix ever heard of her. And who are the Blessed?
Jordan made an impatient noise and stopped, leaning against a pillar.
Well, that's a question we can't answer, and you can imagine how popular those are around here.
He grinned as Kerala laughed.
There have been rumors of miracles around this place for years, right?
Oh, yes, but no truth to them. The latest wave of them began around 2 months ago, around the time the abbot asked Fletcher to move out to the farmstead.
Why did he do that?
Jordan rolled his eyes.
The sword priests were trouble right from the start. When they first arrived, for example, they wouldn't give up their weapons. The abbot himself had to come down and sort it out. After that, they complained about the church and the morning services, saying that the secondary status given to the son and the daughter was an insult. But between you and me, what really drove the abbot to evict them was all the shouting.
Shouting? Have you ever heard sword priests at prayer?
Oh, Kerala said with a wry smile. Shouting.
Jordan nodded. At dawn every morning, and at dusk, they would gather in the common yard between the dormitories and go through their exercises, shouting to the heavens in unison the entire time. I watched them a few times, and I realized that they're supposed to do those prayers with their swords in hand, practicing with them. But the blades were locked up in the registry, and they never got over that. As time went on, they became bored, restless. There wasn't anything for them to do here. There's always several construction and renovation projects going on here. The abbot invited Fletcher to put them to work with his monks, but she declined. Instead, she had them exercise constantly. They would run from gatehouse to gatehouse, trying each day to do it faster, or they'd run a circuit around the outer walls. And when they weren't running, they'd practice wrestling and unarmed combat in the common yard between the dormitories, praying all the while.
More shouting, Kerala sighed.
More shouting. And once the rainy season began and folks spent more time cooped up inside, things got worse. Tempers got shorter. Eventually, the abbot suggested to Commander Fletcher that perhaps she and her men might be more comfortable in the farmhouse outside, where they could shout and swing their swords as much as they wanted. By that point, I think she was as glad to be gone as we were to be rid of her. And once she and her men moved out to the farmhouse, things quieted down. Everyone was waiting for the rains to pass, when it would be safer for her to travel back to the mainland.
Then the miracles started happening, Kerala guessed.
Right. One morning, the pilgrims suddenly went wild, claiming that one of them had received the miracle he'd come for. Naturally, the monks wanted to meet this man and bring him into the abbey to see what had happened to him, but Kelisandra wouldn't hear of it. She'd already decided the man's claim was genuine, and she set her men around the fellow, refusing to let the monks approach him. The abbot asked her to relent, but she wasn't inclined to do him any favors, and it wasn't long after that she and her men took off their red tabards and put on the white clothes of the pilgrims, joining them. Since then, every week or so, another person wakes up in the morning, claiming to have received a miracle cure for their condition. The pilgrims call these folk the Blessed, but there's no way to verify that they've truly been healed. The monks keep sending a group out there every day to investigate, you know. Their calling demands it. But Kelisandra keeps the Blessed away from them.
Very frustrating.
I can imagine, Kerala said. Something like that going on under my nose? I'd have to find out mo—
She suddenly broke off, seeing something out of the corner of her eye, and whirled. At the top of the column nearest them, a tiny winged figure was clinging to the stone, sticking its tongue out at her through a squinched-up face.
Jordan laughed. I was wondering when you'd notice them.
Them?
That's right, them. This is the Hall of Demons.
The Hall of... Kerala said, glancing around.
Then she started to see them, more of the tiny figures clinging to the columns. Many were near the tops, but some were near the floor, peering around the column's base.
The light from the lamps against the walls made the shadows long and flickering, adding movement to the figures. In another moment, she realized they were all gargoyles, a deliberate addition to the column as it had been made. Each column was unique. No two had the creatures in the same location, holding the same poses, or having the same comical expressions. She looked up again at the figure overhead, and as she imagined the sculptor creating it, a smile on his face, she burst out laughing at the delighted whimsy in the figure. "These are demons." Jordan smiled, enjoying her reaction. "It's meant as a reminder that the true demons of this world are only those inside us. Ignorance, fear, pride, selfishness, that sort of thing. Putting the blame for your woes upon external sources only takes away your sense of responsibility to fix them yourself." "I like that lesson. I'll try to remember it."
"I sometimes forget they're in here," Jordan confided, sounding wistful. "When I was a boy, this was my favorite place to go. I used to prowl this hall for hours, trying to find every one of the little fellows. There's over 100, if you can believe it. Some of them are very cunningly hidden. Every time I found a new one, I'd give him a name."
"What's this one's name?" Kerla asked. Jordan frowned.
"Lucius, I think."
He saw Kerla's raised eyebrow and shrugged.
"He looked like a Lucius to me."
Kerla laughed. "If you say so. Nice meeting you, Lucius." She gave the gargoyle a flourishing, elaborate salute, a twinge of grief going through her when she remembered Giacomo used to do that to make her laugh. "Did you give all of them Sabrian names?"
"Not all of them, but I would usually come in here after one of my history lessons, and Imperial history was my favorite subject back then. What we know of it, at any rate."
He fell silent for a moment, then spoke quickly before he lost his nerve.
"Captain Grievous called you Fraternobellum. That means you fought alongside him in a battle, doesn't it?"
Kerla nodded. "More than one. It's an informal title, but one I'm proud to bear." She smiled at him.
"I'm impressed that you know the word. I'd never heard it myself before Grievous used it."
"Do you think that he would be willing to give an interview?" Jordan asked, sounding nervous for the first time since Kerla had met him.
"He might," Kerla ventured. "Would he gain any greater access to the archives?"
"Well, with a patron like the Duke," Jordan admitted, "I'm certain he already has access to anything he'd like to see. We just have so little information on the Empire. All the books we have are decades out of date. Is he famous down there?"
"He has a certain notoriety," Kerla confirmed. "He commanded more than one ship in his career before becoming an instructor at the Imperial Naval Academy."
"Oh, I'd love to interview him," Jordan said. "Anything he has to say would be of great value."
He sighed. "Neither Beneteau nor Master Drusus have been willing to talk about the Empire."
"Really? I thought you and Beneteau were friends."
Alessandra and I are friends," Jordan said glumly. "Beneteau only speaks to her. He treats me like I'm trying to steal something from him."
"Oh, I see. What's Drusus like?"
"Polite, but he keeps to himself."
"That seems to be a common Sabrian trait."
"Well, he doesn't say much more to me than Beneteau. I think that's because his command of free speak isn't the best. I speak some Sabrian, so I'm the one who runs errands for him. Any chance to practice with a native speaker is worth taking."
"Can't argue with that," she agreed. "What is he studying here?"
Jordan chuckled. "Oh, he doesn't tell me anything like that. Our conversations are mostly him asking me to find things in the archives. Mostly older books on a lot of different subjects. Alchemy, herb lore, wildlife on the mainland. Even a study of rocks, written 500 years ago."
"Rocks," Kerla said. She shrugged.
"Okay, a book on rocks. Why not? But none of those books are written in Sabrian, are they? How's he reading them?"
"One of the senior monks, Brother Pharaoh, works with him on the translations. He's our best linguist." He chuckled. "Personally, I think Pharaoh sees this as a chance to practice his own Sabrian."
"Makes sense." Then Kerla got an idea. "Jordan, maybe you and I can do each other a favor. You run errands for the scholars, and you look for evidence to double-check facts, right? So you know your way around the preservatory."
"I suppose," Jordan told her with a shrug. "I like helping the monks with their projects, especially the older ones. They can't get around so well. And they like giving me errands. It allows them to stay focused on their work."
"Okay,
Now, when we arrived, we turned over our weapons and signed our names in a large registry. You said the monks keep everything. Would that include the old logbooks from the registry?
Of course, Jordan replied. The last 50 years or so are kept in the registry. Older volumes are in the archives.
All right, here's my offer. I'll talk to Grievous about giving an interview where you could ask him anything you want. In return, I'd like to know if there's a record of someone visiting the Abbey around 30 years ago, a Sabrian captain named Strabo.
A Sabrian? Jordan asked, suddenly excited. I've never heard of any of them visiting that long ago.
Well, it's possible he was the first, and I don't know for certain that he did come here, but I'd like to know either way. She shrugged. If he did come here, maybe he gave an interview.
Jordan went very quiet, nodding as he listened to her, his eyes unfocused.
Well, finding him in the registry is definitely the first step. His entry should say whether he gave an interview.
He looked at her, his eyes sparkling with interest.
It's a deal. I assume you don't want me to share any of this with Alessandra?
Carola smiled. Is it that obvious?
Jordan chuckled.
Fine, but I don't tell you anything about what she's doing or working on either. I'm not getting involved in the feud between the pair of you. Is that clear?
Carola nodded.
Is Strabo his first name or his last?
At a guess, it's his last. That's all I know.
Jordan nodded.
All right, I'll let you know what I find. Might take a few days, though.
You know where to find me.
This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. Now, if you're looking for more speculative audio fiction to fill the gap between these episodes, but don't know where to look, I recommend checking out Synthetic Voices. Each month, podcast critic Jimmy Rogers recommends a few of his favorite episodes from among a wide variety of speculative fiction podcasts. You'll find his top picks read aloud on the Synthetic Voices podcast or listed on his website, scienceismagic.com. And if you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com. where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.